And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Today, I am back in my chair after 2 weeks away. Last week, we had a rerun, and the week before that, I was not here. So this week, we're going to talk today, because it's summer, about summer road trips and road trip movies and perhaps quest movies. And we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when you get two movie characters or more or less going from point A to point B. It seems simple. Not always. And then I'm going to give the folks around the table a little quiz, which we will get to in a little while. And finally, we will talk about what is making us happy this week. Now, we are working at slightly diminished power in some ways and extra power in other ways. Stephen Thompson and Glenn Weldon are both out of their seats this week. So what will we do? Oh, my gosh. Barry Hardiman.
Yay!
Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at Weekend Edition.
And an occasional pop culture happy hour correspondent.
And a correspondent, yes.
That's right.
I like how promoted I just got.
Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR, and I'm senior correspondent.
Excellent.
He's
fantastic.
The boss of me.
And as we always like to do whenever we have an open spot at the table, our esteemed producer, Mike Katzif, is sitting in. Mike Katzif, we go through this every time. What do you do at NPR?
I write for NPR Music. I do videos for the Tiny Desk Concert Series. I produce this show.
That's right. You
and
have
so many other things.
A variety of eclectic responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Mike is a Renaissance man. Well, I'm glad that you could all be here. And I think we have to begin by acknowledging that we are somewhat sweaty in the D.C. area right about now.
A little bit.
It has been hovering in the 100-degree area.
Sweaty and powerless. Yes.
That's right. We are taping this on Tuesday. There's been no power at my house since Friday night.
Yikes.
So, yeah.
So it's a good time to hit the road.
It is a good time to hit the road. So this is what we thought we would start with. You know, the summer movie is one thing, but the road movie is another thing. And sometimes there's overlap and sometimes not. My personal favorites tend to be the get a couple of people in a car, on a train. You've obviously got your planes, trains, and automobiles. Mm.
That confined space of the car is a sort of frame for drama. There's no surprise that this is a popular type of movie, right?
Right.
It depends on what kinds of combinations you make with the people in that car. They can be best friends, having an escape of some sort. They can be unlikely allies. They can be ill-matched and forced to cross the country in some way.
They can be women on the run from
their
abusive
husbands. They can be women on the run. Yep.
I love when that happens.
We're talking about Tommy Boy.
Right? Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. No, wait. We're talking about Thelma and Louise, of course. One of my favorite underappreciated road movies, I think, is a movie that makes direct reference to that. When Whoopi Goldberg, who is in this movie, says, "I'm not going over a cliff with you two."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about Boys on the Side.
Oh, so
I'm glad you
like
brought this
Boys
up.
On the Side.
It's my
right?
favorite.
Yeah.
Whoopi
like
Goldberg is a lounge singer or a club singer or something like that. She needs to get across the country. Mary Louise Parker is, I forget what her character
she
is.
She was a bartender.
Is she a bartender? But something's
dating a bartender
bad.
And...
Something's gone bad, and she's not well, and she needs to get across the country. She's looking for somebody to share the ride. They stop off on the way to pick up Drew Barrymore, who's in an abusive relationship. There you go, Barry.
Bingo!
And along the way, they become unlikely friends.
And murderesses.
Yes. Oh, I'd forgotten. Spoiler.
Well, this happens in the first, 15
That's
minutes.
True. Yeah. They take on a new friend for Drew Barrymore, who is, anybody remember?
I do.
A fledgling Matthew McConaughey.
Fledgling, but still, yes.
That's who it is.
Poured,
well, of course.
Poured into the uniform of a Texas State Trooper, if I recall.
He looks like he's about to strip every time you see him. It's like, seriously, why are those pants still on?
That's
why that guy's famous, though, to be honest.
And, of course, they picked up the fledgling Brad Pitt briefly in Thelma and Louise. The first time after Growing Pains that anyone noticed Brad Pitt.
Yep, that's true.
Because, of course, I noticed him on Growing Pains. Probably many other people did not. Yeah, I like that one. There's also the man and woman taking the road trip, like in It Happened One Night.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
my favorite.
Later, The Sure Thing, which is basically the same story.
Right.
You know, I honestly, if I tried to put together the circumstances surrounding It Happened One Night, I honestly do not remember exactly
she
how they wind
escaped
up in that
heiress.
That's
Claudette
right.
Colbert is the escaped heiress. Clark Gable is the failed newspaper man. He takes off his shirt. She pulls up her dress. What I love about that that movie is it's right before they started enforcing the 1930 code. I think the movie is 1934. And it's right before. So they could still do that. And, you know, he takes off his shirt. And sales, I believe, this might not be true. This might be apocryphal. But I believe that sales of undershirts plummeted.
Yes.
Because he took off his shirt.
I have heard that, too.
And bingo.
If that is apocryphal and a giant lie, then I have heard that same one that you have. Because I've definitely heard that. And in The Sure Thing, it's, of course, he is a college student. The young John Cusack is a college student whose friend has offered him sort of a free girl over Christmas break, but he has to get out to California and he doesn't have any money. And he winds up being stuck in a car with this young woman played by Daphne Zuniga, who is kind of the uptight,
that's right,
bookish girl.
It's Melrose Place.
In his class. It's Melrose Place.
Oh, fab.
And incidentally, the car that they jump into is driven by Tim Robbins and Lisa Jane Persky, who are both hysterically funny as this couple that sings like show tunes and gets really angry that they won't sing along with the show tunes. Seriously, one of my absolute favorite movies. If you've never seen it, it does kick around on video. There's a whole sort of genre of that kind of movie as well, the kind of romantic stuck in hotel, because you can of course get them stuck in hotel rooms and who's going to sleep in the bed and
unlikely romance. When Harry Met Sally starts out that way,
it does.
It's always better if they hate each other at the beginning.
That's absolutely I would have forgotten that when Harry Met Sally kind of starts with a mini version of this when they take that road trip and wind up in the diner and she orders the pie.
There's a lot of bromances sort of like that too. I hate that word, but recently there was Due Date with Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis.
Galifianakis is the king of these movies.
Well, right. And that sort of points to like one of those types where you're on the road and crazy things happen.
Right.
You go like situation to situation that basically allows you to do like these short vignettes in a certain location. Something bananas happens and they get back on the road.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was like that. A little bit less overtly comedic, but like Y Tu Mamá También was sort of like that too. Where
it's more overt in other ways.
It's more in many, many ways.
In several ways.
Of course, The Hangover is like that.
Yeah.
The Hangover's totally like that. That's a little bit closer to that Quest movie, I think, than being like truly on the road. But that movie Paul with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that one.
And The Alien.
But that one also sort of has that existential like type of road movie that I like a lot. That you see like in Sideways or in About Schmidt. Movies like that.
The road is the destination.
The road is the destination. You're sort of there to ponder and get wrapped up in the landscape and things like that, too.
Right. Sometimes it's very much the imagery of being on the road and traveling and being up against land. That's when you see, like, the Easy Rider imagery, the idea of the open road.
Yeah, I mean, that movie's like Ground Zero first. So much of that imagery of just being out in the wild and seeing the scenes.
And, you know, the open road and the endless landscape as a metaphor for the possibility of change and the possibility
and
of
transition,
the unexpected.
Yeah.
And something that's uniquely American. I mean, I know we were talking about also foreign movies, but I feel like that is a uniquely American.
I was just going to ask, if we think that this is a uniquely American kind of thing, the landscape of Europe is different in some ways.
Yeah.
And I frankly don't know European cinema well enough to know whether there's a strong tradition of this sort of thing.
The closest I can think of is Before Sunrise, which is an American film. It was Richard Linklater, but they meet on a train but then end up in Austria. You know, it has that same sort of traveling and talking and, you know, forcing people together and just having conversation, which I think is a major part of that road movie feel.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. There can be these similarly structured travel from place to place and along the way things happen. Mm-hmm. Because one of the movies I was thinking about, and again, we've talked a little bit about whether there's a difference between a purely road movie, as you were just mentioning, a purely road movie versus a Quest movie.
Right.
And you could see this as either one, but honestly, Stand By Me is a road movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they're walking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's really the same structure. Yeah. It's the idea of as you go, you run into various complications, the leeches, the guys showing up.
Right.
Even though so much of what we associate with road movies is cars,
planes,
and motorcycles, travel, trains, things like that.
Yeah.
That's quintessentially a road movie.
And I would say the same for Wizard of Oz, in which they are walking from place to
place. Yeah, that's true.
And it probably is more of a Quest movie, but they're on the road. They're, in fact, on a road that they sing about quite frequently. But it's the same. That's the same structure.
Road movies are a little bit more aimless in some ways, where they are just kind of going place to place to place, maybe with some sort of MacGuffin of, like, we have to get here by this time.
Right.
Quest movies, I think, have a little bit more of a point
more often.
They're genuinely driven. I mean, I think that the difference is being partly that the road movie has a destination that's just an excuse for them to be on the road.
Right.
Right. Whereas with a quest movie like The Wizard of Oz or something like that, the point is fundamental to the movie.
Right.
Whether it's dramatic or comedic, they really are going
to see the wizard
for the purpose of the thing, as opposed to something like The Sure Thing, where frankly the fact that that he wants to see this girl and she wants to see her wimpy boyfriend, those are not the fundamental things that drive the movie. What drives the movie is the people being thrown together in the, and you can sort of, like I said about It Happened One Night, it's like I don't really remember what the reason was that they were out there.
They're talking so fast.
I don't really remember.
There's so much leg. I don't know.
I don't really remember why she had to stick her leg out, but she did, and they were traveling and it was awesome. And stuff like that.
There is some sort of overlap. One of the movies I just saw on an airplane just recently was that new Duplass movie, Jeff Who Lives at Home, with Jason Segel. And it's more or less a road movie. It's more or less a quest movie in that he goes out of the house. He's like this stoner who lives at home. Mm-hmm. His mom calls and says, can you pick up some wood glue? And then he kind of just goes on this like meandering kind of stonery story where he kind of overlaps and meets his brother, you know, randomly. And things sort of happen, but he's not really like, there's no point beyond, he's sort of in his own head, this going on this existential travel.
Whether it's not just really about the wood glue.
No, not at all. It's just sort of the excuse to go out and do something, explore the world. But he's not going from A to B necessarily. He's just sort of wandering.
Right.
Now, so I think I would say that I prefer quest movies because generally if you are not just on the road for the point of being on the road, you're on the road to, and it is actually a quest for a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's usually a knight in shining armor or some magic involved.
Yeah.
And so that's, I feel like where those two things meet is generally where The Hobbit comes in.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that is where I generally am happiest as a hobbit. With a hobbit.
Well,
near a hobbit.
Or like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. He's looking for something.
Right.
Which enables him to go on the road, but there he is looking for his bicycle.
Right. Although that is way more existential.
The quest movie is
it is
the quest movie is sometimes about finding something, but it's also sometimes about getting rid of something. Speaking of hobbits, it's sometimes it's about getting rid of the ring.
Yeah, that is true. And I think the nice thing about the quest movie, and particularly in these magical realms, is generally if you are looking for something, it turns out that you're always looking for not exactly the right thing. Like you are actually trying to, you know. You had it all along, dear. Just click three times or whatever.
Right.
So that's
say,
the nice thing is that you actually don't need the thing you want, or you don't even need to. You know, there is that kind of trade off between the thing you think you always wanted, and really, it's just those shoes.
Yeah, it's funny. The knight in shining armor thing. There's some overlap with that in the regular old road movie thing.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Too.
Knights. Yeah.
You know, again, to circle back with Boys on the Side. You know, they pick up this sort of family of people along the way, and there's no one of them that's I don't think more important than the other.
Besides Matthew McConaughey's pants, as discussed.
But yeah, the bringing in an outside influence to disrupt the dynamic that's been established in the first reel is, I think, part of both tropes.
Oh, and of course, we have to mention the Muppet movie.
Oh, yeah.
Great road movie. When you were talking about like picking up people along the way, of course, that's the structure of that movie as well. I feel like, and I know that our listeners will help us remember the many, 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 many movies that we're forgetting. Mm. We're leaving out sort of a lot of the fleeing criminals genre.
Oh, yeah. I love like
On the Run
kind
of movies. Yeah.
Either solo, like The Fugitive.
Right.
Or, what is it, The Defiant Ones?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or Midnight Run, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Bonnie and Clyde, yeah.
And Bonnie and Clyde.
And then there's the spies who've been disavowed by their agency type of road movie.
Well, now we're getting hyper-specific.
That's true, yes, exactly. Thank you, Mr. Bourne.
While I was on the road, I put together this list. Broken Flowers was one where Bill Murray is kind of looking for this woman who may or may not have had his son. He's sort of narrowed it down to like these four or five women.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of goes town to town. And so you end up meeting various characters for a very brief amount of time, and then you leave and go to another one. There was that movie Away We Go, which was sort of that same format.
Yes.
I don't know if I loved that movie, but I think it had Maya Rudolph, and I forget who the guy was.
John Krasinski.
They sort of went family to family as they were getting ready to have their baby. They were on the road.
These little vignettes of what family life is in different places.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about what makes a good road movie, it's usually how much do I feel like each one of those individual vignettes is worth watching?
Yes.
And how much do I feel like it's just a series of things where I'm waiting to get to the end?
Yes.
If you have pieces along the way where each piece is something that you would watch, that's one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if everything that you're seeing is the object of some quest or desire or journey is over here and you're over there. Mm-hmm. And it just has to take an hour and 40 minutes for you to get from place
right.
to place.
Yeah, it's just
and
a
that
series
seems
of
to
obstacles.
Be the only reason that the yeah. obstacles
and
exist,
I think,
then you have a problem.
And one of the great things, that's a very good point, is I think this is why I always think of The Wizard of Oz as actually the perfect quest movie, because each single experience that they have, wherein they pick up a scarecrow and a mm-hmm. cowardly lion, whatever, works and builds on the last thing. Mm-hmm. So, and I never want to fast forward through anything.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that's, whereas in Away We Go, I can't believe I just compared those two movies. One
right.
is
I mean,
vastly
it,
superior.
Well,
but,
obviously.
But I think, you know, Away We Go, after I'm done with Maggie Gyllenhaal's, I'm always like, bzzz, mm-hmm. you know, I yeah. want to fast forward.
I guess what I like about some yeah. of those movies, I didn't really love Away We Go by any means, but...
Oh, I liked it, too.
I mean, it was fine.
But and I love the Maggie Gyllenhaal vignette, but the other ones
are something about... being able to, it's like an anthology, you know, mm-hmm. like if you don't like this segment of it, mm-hmm. all you have to do is wait like a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily like that character. You know,
that's a very
you'll
good
see
point.
Like another part. I mean, The Jerk is sort of like that in terms of like a quest where it's almost like these little sketch comedy bits built up to like this grander mm-hmm. journey that he is on.
Yeah. If you're looking for a movie that fits both Mike's smaller scale, more intimate road movie template and gives you an amazing sense of character building. Mm-hmm. And
oh, wait, I have a guess. Go ahead.
No, you don't.
Beavis and Butthead.
I have a guess.
Guess.
Little Miss Sunshine.
No, but not bad. I was going to say Wendy and Lucy. If you haven't seen Wendy and Lucy, then you really want to see
Michelle
Wendy
Williams.
And Lucy. It's Michelle Williams.
My list.
Yeah.
She's
homeless. She's traveling across the country to Alaska. She's got her dog, Lucy.
It's a gorgeous movie.
Wait, Wendy is Michelle Williams and Lucy is the dog,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's sad.
It's so hard.
Very sad movie.
Yes, it is. It is bleak, but it is gorgeous.
It's only about 2 or 3 years old, and I remember the critics just going absolutely ape.
It's
I forget the director.
Movie.
She's the same person who did
Meeks Cut Off.
Kelly Reichardt. Yeah. Well, yes, which was another controversial movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of your road movies, that is also a road movie, but it's a very different one in the sense that so little is happening along the way, and it really is just about the existence of complete uncertainty as to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it really is all in the journey as opposed to being... I mean, obviously, they're desperate to find water
get somewhere.
And figure out where they're going.
But they're lost, so they don't actually know whether they will ever get to their destination.
Right, exactly.
Which is, talk about your open-ended road movies.
Right. Yeah. But since I did bring it up, I will say Little Miss Sunshine is on the sort of happier side of that ledger in the sense that you have that same... character building sort of through the movie, different things that are happening are setting up each individual character and
step
each individual development.
Right.
And it's sort of a combination of this, you know, family has conversations and learns about each other, and also family has wacky adventures and stuff like that. That's one of the reasons I like that movie, is I feel like it's very balanced in
it. It did a really good job of the scenery, too. Like, you felt
like you were on the road.
The vastness of the scenes. Mm-hmm. You're in the desert, you're in, like, these really big, wide open skies. Like, there was something like really beautiful about how they shot that.
Yeah.
And then they would cut to the interior of that van, which is so claustrophobic.
And I love that bit they have in that movie where they have to push the van and jump in with the door as they're closing
it's
the door and everything.
Really good. Yeah.
I think is such a lovely metaphor for sort of the way this family travels is that you
they are fugitives.
And that you sort of have to get behind and push, but everybody ultimately gets on. You don't leave anybody, but sometimes, you know, somebody has to be the person who's like trying to fight to get with everybody.
It's like team building.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I wonder if you need to watch that movie. Again.
Since you're talking about that intersection of, you know, a fairly serious movie about family dynamics that's also quite silly in many, many ways. When we first started talking about road movies, I thought only of comedies.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we've brought up, you know, Lord of the Rings and these kinds of things. But I was also thinking, and Mike had put this on his list, is of Children of Men and these very serious, very big movies in which the road... You know, which is, it's sort of in the area of your smaller serious road movie, but then it can also get bigger and more, you know. And because Children of Men, I think, is one of the great movies of the last 10 years. I think it's a gorgeous movie.
Well, and there are a number of sort of road movies or road stories that are about escaping horrible apocalyptic danger.
Road.
Yeah.
Well,
and The right. Stand.
Oh wait,
is,
The Road.
And the, yeah, The Road.
And The Stand is like
yes,
that.
Exactly.
As a film takes everybody wow. sort of traveling. Mm-hmm. The book I'm saying, and then yeah. when they made the miniseries, which I personally think should have been The Last Word. I think they're making a movie.
Oh
I think
no.
I don't want them to.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I don't want them to. That's also a Road story in the same way. Of
right.
That sort of like you know, there's nothing left to do. And I think frankly, the Steve Carell that's out now, the Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, is mm-hmm. is similar.
Well, yeah. you know, the great American Road movie is all about epic scale mm-hmm. and all about sadness and, mm-hmm. and woe and deprivation. And that's yeah. The Grapes of Wrath.
Right? Oh,
I thought you were going to talk about
Easy Rider. I don't even know how to say enough that mm-hmm. how true that is.
Yeah.
It true. Mm-hmm. I with Trey.
That true. Hulkberry. Hulkberry says that
but yeah,
true.
No. And that's why I guess I wish I could flesh out. I don't know enough about European movies, but I think of these movies as being truly American. And I think you made a really good point about the American landscape being mm-hmm. so much a part of the... Because, you know...
Well, it's part of the origin of settling America,
exactly.
isn't it? On some
yeah.
far enough timeline.
Right.
Let alone, you know, the 1950s when the interstates opened up and people just wanted to get
right.
on the road. It
oh,
was
and
easier
I would,
to go
I would
across
bet
country.
You,
and I
right.
would bet you that if you counted up road movies, I can't guarantee this, but I would bet you that statistically, many more of them go west than go east.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and
oh,
one of my,
sure.
I mean, I think about Far and Away and all of the, you mm-hmm. know, which is a movie I will always watch when it is on cable.
Me too.
Yes. That, oh, I hope someday we're on a couch together when it comes on.
Very not like a little really bad Tom Cruise.
That is
Irish
some bad
accent.
Irish accent.
I know, it's so amazing.
I will say, having either. Brought up the question of the Americanness of the road movie, mm-hmm. I have done some Googling, and I am prepared to step away from my own assertion a little bit. I found a lovely list of 25 excellent global road movies, and I will add it to the blog.
Well,
when
didn't
we,
you say?
Good.
Isn't White Wedding a road movie? The one that you liked so much.
White Wedding is a road movie, and it's
oh.
South African.
Oh yeah.
I just wanted to. I pay attention when you talk, Trey Graham.
Yay!
I remember things you say to me.
White Wedding is a super charming movie.
I remember
please
things
find
you say
it
to
on
me.
Netflix.
Yeah. Look at me remembering. Things.
It's actually both. It's a romantic comedy and a road movie because it's only half. The bride and her party are in Johannesburg, uh-huh. and the groom and his best man are trying to make their way from, I think, Cape Town to Joburg.
Oh, I also yeah. like the one that everyone else hates, Forces of Nature, which with
Sandra
Bullock.
I don't know this.
Ben Affleck.
I like that one too.
It
and
has
the
a
hurricane.
Very, it has a very bad uh-huh. reputation, yeah. but it actually has a very interesting contemplative sort of ending and philosophy toward its story.
I totally
and I was
agree.
Trying to remember it, and I just thought of it. Forces of Nature, underestimated movie. But what I'm taking away from this conversation in general that we've had about road movies is that people use travel for a variety of things,
not
as
just
a,
to get someplace,
right? but as a storyteller, you can use it to sort of hang incidents on.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can use it to represent some serious idea of people yearning, right?
You can use the journey to shape character, which I think is the most interesting.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Because right. you
Absolutely.
Know you're not going to end the same way you began.
Right.
Right. So do you have a favorite, Mike Katz, a favorite road movie?
You know, I was just thinking that. I was thinking Almost Famous might be one of my favorites.
That's a good one.
For
That's
a long
lovely.
Time, for so many different reasons. But as soon as I kind of pinpointed that, that was a road movie. And you have serious things that happen. You have character change, mm-hmm. but crazy things also can sort of happen.
Yeah.
It just romanticizes being on the road with a band and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I like that movie a lot.
Trey, favorite?
I couldn't possibly pick a favorite, but I will name an underappreciated Quest movie. If you like The Princess Bride, you will probably like this.
Mm-hmm.
Claire Danes is a star. And I don't mean is the star of the movie.
This movie.
She is an actual star
yes.
who has fallen out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Cox is mm-hmm. the hero.
And he's adorable.
What has, he's so cute.
Oh
what
God.
Has happened to him? What does he do now?
He is now on, there's some HBO thing that he's on right now.
In any case, we
yeah,
will
sorry.
We will look that up.
Yes. Tell you where
Peter
his
O'Toole.
Are.
Peter O'Toole is in this movie. Ricky Gervais is in this movie, and
That's
Michelle
right.
Pfeiffer
well,
is the big
the
bad.
What the heck is it?
It's
right.
called Stardust,
That's
and
what
it's
I thought.
It is
oh,
yeah. it is unexpectedly good. It yeah. looks terrible from the trailer and from the ads, but it's unexpectedly good. I enjoy
it's based
it
on a comic or a graphic novel. Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
It's
I think
Neil Gaiman.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Of course it is.
Yeah, it's Neil Gaiman. Yeah. It's and therefore thereby making ensuring that its story is absolutely lovely.
At least you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite, Barry?
Obviously, I feel very strongly about It Happened One Night. And I you know, we've already talked about this, but I love Boys on the Side. I will watch it anytime. It was one of the great sort of female movies in which I sort of, I remember as when it came out, I thought, oh, you mean I could go to a commune and live with all my girlfriends who I know I like better than boys in Tucson, and the Indigo Girls will literally be singing in a bar.
Of course you
so can. So that, though, those things sort of appealed to me. But then again, and this is obviously, I can't pick a favorite, I will also say,
City Slickers.
The Wizard of Oz is, I mean, come on. I will always watch it when it comes on. Yeah. I'm married to someone from Kansas.
Is Blazing Saddles a road movie?
You could make that argument, I think.
Well, I think I would definitely be lying if I did not say The Sure Thing, and everyone who knows me knows that that is my road movie.
There we go.
All right. Well, if you have a favorite road movie or a favorite quest movie, or if you cannot believe what we left out, which happens every week.
Every week.
Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or find us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. For our second segment today, we are in the thick of the summer movie season. So I have written you up a little quiz about summer box office.
Oh, boy.
Summer box office, past and present.
Okay.
Summer, for the purpose of the charts that I looked up at Box Office Mojo, thanks Box Office Mojo, is defined as the first weekend in May through Labor Day weekend. And when they talk about a summer movie, they include all the movies that open during that period. Mm-hmm. So it has to have opened between those two periods. And when you talk about its box office take, though, that's the entire box office take.
Domestic.
Exactly. I was just going to say. We're going to start with you, Barry Hartman.
I'm going to fail this. I mean, I like movies, but
I'm
bad with money.
A lot of these are extremely difficult, I'm just going to say. And the point is more to sort of get it out there.
Let the record show that we are doing this on the honor system. We will not be Googling.
Right. No Googling, no. Trey.
We might Bing it, though.
Bing it. But then thereby ensuring we will not get the answer. Sorry, Bing.
Wow. All right. So the last time, Barry, that the biggest movie of the summer, by which I mean the biggest moneymaker, was not part of a series or a franchise or based on an existing character was 2003.
Oh, I thought for sure it was going to be Titanic, but it can't
2003.
Be. What was I? Where was I in 2003? Was I wearing halter tops? Okay, I'm there. Let's
go. I'll give you a couple hints. It's animated.
Okay.
It's aquatic.
No. Oh,
no way.
Yeah.
Really?
What?
Finding Nemo?
It's Finding Nemo. Wow. Biggest movie of 2003. Trey Graham. Before that... The last one that was not part of a series or a franchise or an existing character and wouldn't later become a series, right, was 1998. And that one was an Oscar contender. 1998. Barry knows the answer.
Hint, please. Barry just did the hand sliding down the glass thing.
No,
am
it's
I wrong?
Not Titanic.
Not Titanic.
Oh darn it!
It's your go-to. It's your go-to.
It is actually. It is actually Saving Private Ryan.
Oh,
wow!
Biggest movie of the summer of 1998. They
you didn't
used
give
to
me a
sometimes.
Hint.
I know.
Well, that could have been. I mean, if you think
that's true, that could have been.
They used
the same.
To sometimes release Oscar contending movies in the middle of the summer. They don't do that very much anymore.
Less so these days.
My cats, if you might know the answer to this.
I might.
Titanic! Just kidding.
How many summers, counting this summer so far, counting this summer so far, which I think we can say we already know what the biggest movie of this summer is going to be. Counting this summer so far, how many of the last 15 summers have had superhero films as their number one?
The last 15 years.
Last 15 summers.
I feel like they've had a superhero movie every year since, like, X-Men.
Right, but I'm talking about number one of the summer.
I feel like I just count... X-Men, Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2. I'm going to say 8 out of that.
Not as many as you would think. 4, actually. The Avengers,
Dark Knight,
Spider-Man, and Spider-Man 3.
Ooh, but not Spider-Man 2?
Which is the best?
That's the next question. Barry Hartman.
What beat out Spider-Man 2?
Yeah. Spider-Man 2 in 2004 was beaten by another second installment of a series. Again, animated. Second installment of an animated series.
Can somebody make a hand gesture? No.
Happy Feet 2.
It is not Happy Feet 2.
Okay, animated.
Animated. Second installment.
To Infinity 2004. And beyond.
No.
I would have thought that too.
No, think greener.
Shrek.
Shrek 2.
Yeah.
That was huge.
Shrek 2 in 2004 beat Spider-Man 2.
I'll buy that.
For biggest film of the summer. Trey Graham, let's test your memory of recent history. What was the biggest movie of last summer?
Oh,
I can't do this. I cannot do this.
See, some of them that seem...
It all goes right away.
That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have gotten this either.
I haven't the faintest idea.
The answer is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Yeah. Mike Katzeff, what was the last time the biggest movie of the summer was primarily a non-animated romance? Meaning you can't count the...
Meaning I can't count Trek
2. Do you know when Titanic was released?
It's like, no, it seems like 1998, doesn't
it? But do you know if it came out in the summer?
I think it was a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Oh.
It just lasted probably till Christmas.
It just seemed like it was so hot outside.
There was a
sweat on the windows.
I don't know why I can remember that.
These statistics go back to 1982, and I will tell you there is one year in that period of time where the biggest movie of the summer was a classic romantic drama. Straight at the weepy hearts of women.
I was going to say My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but I don't think that made like billions
of dollars. Clay-covered hearts.
Oh, God.
It's Ghost.
Idea. Yeah.
Oh.
Ghost. In 1990, beating Total Recall, Die Hard 2, Dick Tracy, Back to the Future 3, and a bunch of other stuff that might theoretically have made a number one movie.
Everything beat Dick Tracy.
Well, yes.
I love Dick Tracy. I even had the soundtrack.
What I'm including there is all the things you might have expected looking at a list going into
original
this.
Songs by...
Manny Patinkin?
No. Stephen Sondheim.
Stephen Sondheim, because I knew it was Megan McSexton. I'm in the ballpark.
Barry Hardiman.
I'm in the nerd ballpark.
Barry Hardiman, in 1995, the number one movie of the summer was Batman Forever, with a relatively anemic $184 million. Compare that, for example, to the previous year when it was Forrest Gump at $329 million, or the year before that when it was Jurassic Park at $357 million.
Oh my God, I'm so old.
This question is not that hard.
Okay.
Batman Forever beat out a few movies that underperformed, including Judge Dredd, but also a classic Kevin Costner flop.
Waterworld. Kevin Costner flop. I mean,
that's
you're forgetting about the postman and the baseball movie. He did not have a good track record there for a while.
Which baseball movie?
He was like an aging pitcher or something. And
in Field of Dreams?
No.
Bull Durham?
No, it was after that.
It's much newer than it's from the early 2000s.
I do remember now the one you're talking about. And I don't remember the golf one either.
No.
Anyway, Trey Graham, in the summer of 1992, the top film was Batman Returns, and the number two film was Lethal Weapon 3. But the 3 and 4 films of that summer of 1992 were about women. Bunches of women.
Ladies. Clumps of ladies.
Clumps of ladies. One starred Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay. Clumps of ladies starring... Sister Act.
Sister Act.
Yeah.
And one starred Gina Davis.
There's No Crying in Baseball.
A League of Their Own.
Yes.
Very good, Trey Graham.
I did like that movie.
I love both of those.
Okay. In 2011, Mike Katzeff, Box Office Mojo tracked 202 films released in the summer, 2011, last year. How many approximately did it track in the summer of 2002, 10 years earlier? Now remember, there were 202 last year. 180, 150, 120, or 100?
What about 120?
It was actually 157 in 2002, 10 years earlier. But I will give you this piece of trivia. Of the 80 that were released in 1992... Because 10 years before that, it was only 80. 59 of them earned at least $1 million. Hmm. Of the 202 that were released in 2011, 67 of them made at least $1 million.
Ouch.
So many, many, many more movies, but not that many more that
see even a million bucks.
I'm so glad you explained that. That was coming perilously close to Jane Has Five Apples.
But what I'm saying is that a lot of that bulk volume is coming from movies that don't even make $1 million.
Yeah,
it's coming from genuinely tiny little nobody sees them movies.
Which is funny because we think of summer as the time for big blockbusters.
That's really interesting.
But even in the summer, you get a lot of movies that never even see $1 million.
Yep.
So partly just because of, I think, you know, more little distribution methods and stuff like that.
But like Green Lantern.
But I thought that was interesting. At any rate,
it is.
That brings us to the end of our quiz, and you've all done very well.
That was a fun quiz.
That was fun. I like quizzes.
I like statistics.
Statistics are fun. I love charts. And again, thanks to Box Office Mojo, where you can find all kinds of awesome... They are not sponsoring us, I'm just saying.
That's true.
All kinds of awesome breakdowns. And
when was Titanic released? In the winter.
And you can look at all kinds of nifty breakdowns and by various categories. And that brings us to the final segment that we do every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Barry Hardiman, I'm so happy to see you, and I'm so happy that you're here, and that's part of what's making me happy this week. Oh, but what's making you happy this week?
Well, I went to see a movie last week, and during the previews, I suddenly heard a familiar tune. Mm-hmm. And it was, I dreamed a dream in time gone by. And I am telling you, when I heard the wistful strains of Les Miserables waft out over mm-hmm. the audience, I was with a friend of mine. We looked at each other. We squealed. We giggled. We gasped. Les Miserables on film. Somehow this, I missed it. But Anne Hathaway.
Hugh Jackman.
Under the direction of Tom Hooper.
Pants, yes. Yep. I mean, this
Tom
is going to be.
Tom Hooper who gave us the King's Speech.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that made me happy. And then, because it reminded me of how much I actually legitimately love that soundtrack, which I know. You're right. Actually, will you cut that from just
No, we need the nerd correction.
I know. I can't believe I did that.
You love the cast album.
I love the cast album, the London one especially. Mm. And I do want to say I got to drive very early in the morning to the airport this weekend, and I listened to it almost the entire first act, and it was really, I remembered how much I loved every single song except for, of course, Castle on a Cloud. But yes.
You want to kill that child.
Exactly. Well, I kind of want to kill the whiny Eponine stuff too, but it's fine. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, wink, I really love the soundtrack. Love the cast album. Very excited to see a very, very wistful, sad Anne Hathaway shave her head. So.
Excellent. Lovely. Thank you, Barry. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
The trailer for a Lifetime remake of a towering cinematic achievement is recently out, and the talent in it is formidable, as Barry might like to say. Jill Scott, who proved herself a very, very fine actress in the Alexander McCall Smith movies. What was it called?
The number one
Ladies Detective Agency. Felicia and her daughter, Condola Rashad, Alfre Woodard, and Queen Latifah in the role played by Sally Field in Steel Magnolias. The trailer for this remake looks kind of tasty just in and of itself, but chiefly what's making me happy is that it reminded me of just how quotable that movie is. Among my people, it is practically a catechism. Oh. You know, other people say, settle down now, Barry Hardiman, or you need to check yourself. But my people say, drink your juice, Shelby. So the trailer made me rewatch several of my favorite scenes this afternoon, including the one about track lighting and Mark, Rick, or Steve, and that made me happy. Also, something that you might want to mark your calendar for, coming to the United States this fall, a thing called Secret Cinema. You sign up, you shell out like $60 or something like that, $60-$75, and you're told to show up in X place at Y time, dressed like someone who works in Z profession. And then you get taken to a secret location, which recently in London...
Where you're mugged.
I know, right? Which in London, the most recent iteration of this, the secret location turned out to be a 190,000 square foot warehouse that had been tricked out to look like a massive spacecraft with actors bustling around, sort of doing things. And in this setting, in this interactive environment, you watch a film whose title is secret until it comes on screen. And in this case, in London, it was Prometheus. So that is secret cinema. I can't tell you what the film is going to be because it's secret. And they ask you to keep the secret until the whole run of the performances is over. But it's coming to New York this fall, and I am totally going to be there.
What profession were the Prometheus folk told to dress as?
Various scientific and technical fields.
Robots.
Okay. Yeah, I am a professional robot. Thanks
Film
for having
critics.
Me.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice. Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
All right. Mike Katzeff, what's making you happy this week?
The idler wheel is wiser than the driver of the screw, and the whipping cords will serve you more than ropes will ever do, which is the long-winded title of Fiona Apple's new album, which is amazing.
It's awesome.
You know, when I think I started hearing rumors that this record was coming out 2 years ago and had been possibly shelved, or she was holding on to it, or maybe she was reworking it, you know, I've been looking forward to this for a really long time. And it's been, I think, since 2005. When I first started as an intern, her last record came out in the fall of 2005. And that record was sort of famously held back by her and then the producers and then the...
Right, I remember this.
You know, it created like that big grassroots groundswell of like the Free Fiona thing where the label was holding it. She redid it. So it's been a really long time since she has put out anything. And a lot of times when there is that gigantic gap between records, especially for someone who has been sort of in the business for as long as she has, the expectation is it can't possibly live up to that weight. And this is her fourth record, and for someone who has really not put much out, and with so many gaps between records, all fans really have time to do is just pore over and analyze her and look at those lyrics and try to get into her head. And for someone who's very peculiar and standoffish towards the press, and she has like many, many famous sort of freaking outs in public and on stage accepting awards, she has a lot of baggage. And so when this record came out and we finally got to hear it, let's just say I was super relieved how actually great it was, mm-hmm. and the music itself. And there have been a ton of articles that have sort of come out, think pieces in New York Times and in Pitchfork and in Spin magazine, trying to get into her head and talk about what it's like to be this very OCD, very off-putting person in some ways, but clearly a genius. But I think what gets lost in all of that discussion, which I think is sort of valuable, but maybe overblown, I think, at this point, is the fact that how great of a musician she really is and how great her lyrics are and how well composed her music is. Mm-hmm. And it's just really awesome to have her back. Coincidentally, Cat Power, who's very similar in that way, she's putting out a new record coming out, in August or September, that will be, I think, just as great. So,
and I think you can actually hear Fiona Apple talk to Guy Raz, right? Didn't she talk to
him? Yes.
Yeah, so if you want to hear a little, mm-hmm. a little NPR plug for you. Yeah.
There you go. Excellent. Very, very good.
So Fiona Apple, after all these years, still awesome.
Wonderful. Glad to hear it. Well, let's see. What is making me happy this week? I have two books to recommend. One is by Jennifer Weiner, and it's called The Next Best Thing. And she's written a bunch of things, some of which I have loved very, very much, and some of which I have not liked as much. But this is back to being one that I really did respond to, and I really do like. Also, Pamela Ribbon, who is a writer I know personally a little, who also writes kind of in this area of sort of really smart women's fiction, has a book called You Take It From Here, which is about two friends who are in this kind of very difficult situation, which you sort of have to read the book to find out about. Pam is also a terrific writer. She's done some writing for television. She was a writer on Samantha Who, which was a really good show, and has worked on some other shows, but also writes novels. And her previous novel, which was called Going in Circles, is also really, really good. And it's one of those books that I cried at a bunch, even though it's not sad. The new one is kind of sad, but Going in Circles, I just cried because it was very sort of relatable. But I definitely recommend both of those books. And you can find out more about both of them on the blog, because I wrote about them today. But I also want to make mention of the fact that over the weekend, while trying to escape the power outage, I saw Magic Mike. And I'm just going to tell you,
I was wondering if you're going to weigh in on that.
I'm just going to tell you, as silly as they have made that movie look in the trailers, it remains a Steven Soderbergh movie.
Yeah.
And it's really actually quite thoughtful in a bunch of ways, and I actually really enjoyed it.
I have not seen it yet, but I've heard the same thing from several mm-hmm. people who have, that it's surprisingly nuanced.
It's surprisingly thoughtful. Yeah. The main reason why you get stripping scenes in it is to understand what these guys are doing. I mean, obviously, there is also some prurient interest in it. I'm not saying there isn't. But they feel like you're trying to get an idea of what this job is, and you're trying to get an idea of how it works and why they do it and what it's like to do it. But the best reason to go to this movie is this performance from Matthew McConaughey as the guy who owns the club, who clearly has been in this business but is not really active anymore. He serves as the host, but he's not really stripping anymore. And it's, you see plenty of Matthew McConaughey, don't worry. He's a really interesting actor. I've talked about this before. I saw him not long ago in Bernie, which Richard Linklater directed. Mm-hmm. He was very good in The Lincoln Lawyer, which is kind of this genre lawyer picture. And one of the things that I've said about him in the past is that really smart directors understand that what he really is an astonishingly good-looking character actor, mm-hmm. as opposed to using him in like leading man roles opposite Kate Hudson. That's mm-hmm. where you get crap. Yeah. That's where you get nothing interesting.
He's like a Paul Newman.
But when you use him as a character actor, in, you know, as he started out in like Dazed and Confused mm-hmm. and stuff like that, mm-hmm. he can be a really fascinating guy to watch. And he's really terrific in this movie.
Yeah. I saw an essay recently that actually, I think the headline asked the question, is he the new Paul Newman? Is he going from golden boy, pretty boy mm-hmm. into this interesting middle-aged character?
He really is such an interesting actor to
me. He's so charismatic that I think at some point, like, that's going to carry over into those more mature roles.
He burns off the screen. I don't mean that salaciously. I mean, he is just absolutely, he's all charisma.
One of the general rules I have about actors is that most actors are better when they sort of push against whatever their natural appeal is. You certainly learned that with guys like Hugh Grant, who was a certain kind of enjoyable actor when he was doing kind of the front-handed,
twinkly.
You know, the twinkly Four Weddings and a Funeral, like foppish,
floppy
whatever.
Yeah.
Stammering.
But as soon as he figured out that he should be kind of a jerk, or at least there should be a strand of jerk, you started to get not only these really funny, much funnier performances and stuff like Bridget Jones, but also these really interesting performances and stuff like About a Boy.
Say About a Boy was about as a new one.
And he's such a good actor, and he so badly needs to push back against against himself and against what your natural response to him is on screen. I think the same thing is true of actresses. And I think for a lot of actresses, it's hard to find a good role for example, you know, if you look at Gwyneth Paltrow in something like The Royal Tenenbaums, she's sort of playing into and yet there's a little tension with that kind of wispy thing she has. There's a little bit of kind of tension and weirdness in that performance.
Honestly, Tom Cruise gets that
absolutely
too. I mean,
yes.
Vanilla Sky and Magnolia. He really plays into his type, but also, you know, finds a way to be different than
and,
that.
And when you sort of...
I'm hoping Rock of Ages may have that
might,
a little bit of that.
The other really interesting thing about Tom Cruise, his best performance as kind of a slick guy playing very much into what he was, for me, was in Rain Man, he is that guy, but he's also kind of unlikable, but the unlikability kind of comes back around to where you sort of get him to.
That's a good point. So I thought you were going to say Jerry Maguire.
I think most actors should be pushing a little bit against what your natural response to them is when you see them on screen, and McConaughey is very much like that.
Yeah.
So the short version of that is actually see Magic Mike and don't think of it as a stripper movie. I really thought I knew where that story was going from the very beginning, kind of just from the setup, and I did not at all, and I appreciated that too.
Well, I mean, like you said at the very beginning, you should never underestimate someone like Steven Soderbergh. Mm-hmm. Boogie Nights, for all intents and purposes, was a porn movie.
Right.
But, you know, it's P.T. Anderson directing that movie, so you know it's going to be more than just that thing.
Right. And even Soderbergh's sort of more commercial movies,
they're always still sort of subversive,
tend to still be a bit subversive and interesting. Yeah. And
Contagion.
Well, and he can make such fun movies about just people talking, like in Ocean's 11. There are some conversations in this movie that are a little bit reminiscent of some of what they got going in Ocean's 11 and kind of that fun talk.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually was a big fan of it. Not Rock of Ages. We'll talk about that another time. We'll talk about that another time. Rock of Ages, I hate Ted.
Crush my hopes and
capital
dreams.
Hey, capital Ted.
Oh, no.
but that is what's making me happy this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman, H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N, B Hardiman. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Mike, our esteemed producer and sit-in, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music. You're hearing it right now. You can follow our missing comrades, Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N, and Stephen Thompson at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. We look forward to seeing them back here. I appreciate all of you being here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I appreciate all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.